Friends, ladies and gentlemen, wonderful of so many of you to turn out this afternoon for a conversation that could hardly be more timely and could hardly be better served for purposes of a good and informative and forward-looking discussion than by the gentleman to my right, Jim Wolfenson, who is a personal friend, an institutional friend, a trustee of this institution, and has some other credentials that make him just the right person to get us started on the topic of how to secure the future for Palestinian youth. Jim and I are going to engage in a bit of a dialogue for a few minutes up here at the beginning, then we'll turn it into a multilogue involving as many of you as possible, and in about 40 minutes or so, we'll turn the program over to an excellent panel that's assembled here. And we thank our friends and colleagues from the New America Foundation, which has been helping us put this event together, and some subsequent ones still to come. I won't introduce the panel now. I would, however, like to say to Congressman Ellison what a pleasure it is to see him back here at Brookings. He's been a frequent visitor here, and we're the better for it. Look forward to listening to you this afternoon. I don't think I need to go on at too much length about Jim Wolfenson's background.
Good.
Well, we'll just stop right there. He's come to talk to us about fencing this afternoon, a sport from his youth, which he's taken up once again in middle age.
Early middle age.
Right. But in addition to being an athlete and an Olympian, he has also been, of course, a global public servant. He was that in his capacity as the president of the World Bank. And then in 2005, 2006, he was the special envoy for the quartet working on the Middle East in general and the issues and challenges of Gaza in particular. Subsequent to that, he, as a Brookings trustee, has enabled us here at Brookings to establish the Wolfenson Center on Development, which has a number of very timely, high-impact projects underway, one of which is the Middle East Youth Initiative, which the Wolfenson Center is conducting in partnership with the Dubai School of Government. What I thought I might do to get the conversation started is to ask Jim to reminisce a little bit with the wisdom of hindsight. And I remember being with him in Jerusalem in 2006, and he had the wisdom of foresight as well. That was a rather critical moment in his work on Gaza, and he was very, very concerned about the connection between the economic restrictions on Gaza and what were likely to be the political developments, both in Gaza, among the Palestinians, between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So, Jim, maybe recalling that time we met together in Jerusalem, you could look back a little bit and see what you think are the principal lessons are, especially as they apply to the situation today, a year after the worst of the military activity, but there have been, of course, troubles just in the headlines in the last couple of days as well.
Well, to take you back to those days and to allow me to reminisce just a trifle, the situation was, as you will recall, that there was great tension between Israel, the West Bank and territories, and Gaza. And one of the activities in which the quartet was involved, the quartet being the United States, Russia, the UN, and the European Union, was to try and see if we could help in any way to unlock this difficult situation. It was really no thanks to my efforts or indeed the quartet's that Eric Sharon decided that the first step in what he wanted to do was to withdraw from Gaza. And that was a momentous decision, and at the time perceived to be full of hope. It was a time when, as you will recall, the million-plus people in Gaza were negotiated with in terms of the withdrawal, and the 7,000 or so Israelis that were there largely involved in hothouse production were given the opportunity, or rather were encouraged to leave, including leaving the hothouses. But the bottom line of it was that essentially there was to be this withdrawal, and the Israelis were to leave, and one way and another we raised a bit of money to pay the owners of the hothouses to leave them there, and there was for a time production by the Palestinians in those hothouses. The hope was that that would be an industry that would allow for an income in the area and for some material benefits to the Palestinian population, and that we could move forward thereafter. And with the arrival some months later of Hillary Clinton, you may remember, there was, not Hillary Clinton, I'm sorry, the Secretary of State came over, and I see the former Consul General is here, so he will remember this. There was a understanding reached between the Israelis and the Palestinians in relation to a forward-looking economic viability for Gaza, which included a port, which included an airport, which included access and egress from the country, and movement between Gaza and the West Bank, bus service, and all the things that we had hoped for. In the event of that moment of agreement in which the Secretary made the announcement and then moved on, the tragedy of the situation was that none of it lasted for very long. And the situation collapsed with violence on both sides and essentially the creation of what now exists in worse form, the closing off of Gaza and the isolation of the residents. It's now at a peak, as you know, with very high unemployment and with little or no activity, with access and egress for goods basically through tunnels. It is a very unhealthy situation, and worse than that, within the context of the 1.4 million or so people that are in Gaza and the 2.3 million Palestinians that are in the West Bank, there is now a division, as I think you know, between Hamas and Fatah, so that there is a dichotomy of the people. So we now have a situation instead of the dream that we'd hoped for, and with some of us, I think, hoping that Gaza would be the first step to normalization on the West Bank, led by Eric Sharon. As you know, Eric Sharon went into a coma, where he still is, and the situation has eroded to the current situation. That's a very brief history of what happened for those of you that are not familiar with it. And so now we're faced with a situation where the dream of a united Palestine with talk of nationhood has receded into the background. Although in June, Prime Minister Netanyahu made an announcement that was certainly a surprise to me, that he would accept a two-state solution of Palestinians and Israelis, subject to a couple of conditions. One was that there would be limited military capacity on the part of the Palestinians, and that the issue of immigration would be taken off the table in terms of the right of return to Israel of Palestinians. And there was a third element, which was to be the unity of Jerusalem, in which at least there was an opening for discussion in terms of the holy places and in terms potentially of some sort of division. But the two key positions were the ones that he took. So we're now in a situation where, very sadly, we have from that dream a situation which is unfortunate, with a division between the Palestinian people, with anxiety about Gaza, between Israel and the Palestinians, leaving, as Strobe was telling me before, I think, with some violence in the last days, which I missed. We are now where we are, with a sort of offer from, or a willingness on the part of Prime Minister Netanyahu to negotiate, and difficulty with who to negotiate with and what are the terms and conditions on which it can be commenced. Abu Mazen taking a predictable and position in relation to settlements and in relation to further encroachments, as he sees it, by the Israelis in Palestinian territories, and with really a standoff, all within the context of a much broader Middle East set of issues than we had a few years ago, with Iran being, of course, major, with a Sunni-Shia split, which is not trivial and which has very serious political implications. And it's taken a minute to tell you this, maybe longer than I should, but as those of you who know the area know, it's not uncomplicated. And I tried to do it as quickly as I could.
Jim, you mentioned having worked closely and well with the previous administration, the Bush administration. That administration got some criticism when it first came into office and later for not engaging with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Certainly that's something that the Obama administration cannot be accused of, but it has gotten some criticism for having engaged at the get-go, but not having been able to develop much traction. What's your own assessment of how the Obama administration has handled the situation in its first year?
Well, I think that the initial statements were timely, accurate, and correct. It was to say, this is one of the key issues that we need to resolve, and we're going to get into it, and we're going to deal with it. And they appointed an admirable person in George Mitchell to be the center point of this, and gave him, I think, and continue to give him appropriate backing. My own judgment is that events, broader events, have pushed that more into the background than perhaps they would have hoped originally. We have had an extension of the problems which the president inherited, starting in before, but certainly made visible in September of the year before, with the Lehman Brothers crisis, which was the visible symbol of the most recent and serious economic downturn, which has prevailed during the course of last year with negative growth in our country for the first time in 60 years. And combined with that, the involvement of American forces in Afghanistan, the combination of our activities overseas in terms of defense expenditures, an accumulating budget deficit, a 10% plus primary unemployment, and probably a combined unemployment of 16-17% at a minimum. When you're president of the United States and you're looking at the range of problems, yeah, I think you'd have to say that those problems, certainly on the face of it, are more significant than 11 million people combined with the Israelis and the Palestinians in a sea of 350 million Arabs. Notwithstanding the importance to all of us about that particular issue, and notwithstanding the fact that when you talk to Israeli and Palestinian friends, they perceive this as being the center of the universe. It is not the center of the universe, and events around it have really made this particular issue, which is becoming more and more a specialist issue, is just not getting, Strobe, I think, the attention. Now, recently, the Secretary of State has announced that they're going to come together. I saw the ambassador to the UN 2 days ago, where she made some comments at a gathering that I was at, in which she said they're quite serious about moving forward to try and resolve this, highly consistent with the statement made by Secretary Clinton. But I think George Mitchell at the moment is having some difficulty in formulating the way forward, and we're all waiting for that magic set of statements which will include support by Syria, Arab countries, and all the things that we all hope for, but which have not yet appeared. So with the tension and violence in relation to Gaza, with the economic drama in Gaza, with the split between Gaza and the West Bank, notwithstanding a substantial easing, which I've seen with my own eyes, in the West Bank recently in terms of movement and activity, I think you'd have to say that the future is uncertain, though I'm thrilled that the statements are being made that this will again be given high priority.
Jim, since the word youth figures both prominently in the name of the initiative that the Wolfensohn Center is doing with the Dubai School of Government and also in the topic of our discussion this afternoon, would you, and then after this we'll open it up to all of you, would you just reflect a little bit about what your motivation was for wanting to concentrate as much on youth as you have done, both when you were working as special envoy and also subsequently? And if I could just append to that a question that is puzzling, disturbing, and timely, and that is the issue of terrorism and, in particular, suicide bombing. This is a phenomenon of our time on which youth has no monopoly, Palestinians have no monopoly, Arabs have no monopoly. It's a global problem. But it's young Arab suicide bombers are a big part of that phenomenon. And how do you relate that to the nexus of politics and economics that you've been concentrating on in Gaza?
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's at the core of stability, I think, in the Middle East and in many other places. I think in coming years also in Africa, where we will have a population by 2050 of 2 billion people, with half of them or more young.
And the most famous recent would-be suicide bomber was from Africa.
That's exactly what I'm just about to say. The situation, we're talking about a global issue. We're not just talking about an Arab issue or the issue of frustration of youth works lots of places. But the situation in the Middle East is, which we're addressing at our center here, is that there are roughly 350 million Arabs in the region, of whom 100 million are, give or take, between the ages of 15 and 25, and whom maybe 130, 140 million are under the age of 15. So you have more than 65% under the age of 25. Now, in the cohort 15 to 25, which are looking for work, my colleagues afterwards will no doubt give better numbers than I have, but if you say that there are 4 or 5 million of these young people who need jobs every year, the generation of jobs, which is not too great anyway when you take out government service, or even if you include it, still leaves somewhere between 2 to 2.5 million of these young people unable to find work. And so you have a continuous addition to the core of unemployed, delays in the ability of young people to get married, delays in their ability to earn a livelihood, which would permit that, and not surprisingly, acute frustration, given the mores and customs of the region. And it is to us in the work that we're doing here, and which we've been joined now in Dubai and in Qatar, where we have centers of research and we've looked at 11 countries, this issue is not just an issue for specialists. This is an issue which is at the very core of economic and social stability. As you could imagine in our country here, if we had 30-40% of our young people unable to get work every year and it was increasing, we would have a hell of a problem. Well, that's exactly what we're finding in the Middle East. So that the question of jobs, which is the first part of what Strobe said, is really crucial in terms of economic development. And as I think many of you know, the societies generally in the Middle East are not orderly in the sense of giving everybody an opportunity to move up the chain. There is, in many of the countries, a select group which is more fortunate than the group below, to put it elliptically, but it's quite clear. And so we have these societies which, to start with, are vulnerable in terms of young people who are looking for a more democratic environment. And then without jobs, you quickly get to the point, which is the second part of Strobe's question, that for young people who are frustrated, there are opportunities to either stick with it and keep going, or there is an immediate sense of violent reaction. And if the violent reaction is one that can be focused and it can be put within a context of religious belief that violent action which leads to death is not the worst thing in the world that can happen to you because of what will happen in the afterlife, even if you get a few people that believe that, you have a very dangerous structure. And what we've seen lately is that the combination of frustration, anger, lack of opportunity, and a sense that life now is less good than maybe life hereafter, you have a combination which is pretty dangerous. And I'm afraid that that's what we now have in the Middle East, with a frustrated youth, and in some countries with inadequate leadership in terms of bringing the resources of those countries together, as I know from my period in the World Bank. This is something that needs to be worked through, whether or not there is an Israel issue. It is a serious issue anyway. And as I said, the split within the Arab community, the Sunni-Shia split, has within it, I think, also seeds of some difficulty. So I hope very much that my successors and all the people that are training at Brookings will come up with much better ideas than my generation had, and that this thing can be resolved, and that there will be an Arab leadership that is far-seeing and that can bring about a greater balance.
Thank you, Jim. We have about 10 minutes or so for some questions. If you have a question, there's a gentleman right over there. Please identify yourself and wait for the microphone. Good. You got it?
Thank you. Thank you very much for your remarks, Mr. Wolfenson. My name is Michael Hager, president of the Education for Employment Foundation, which is active in five of the Middle Eastern countries, including West Bank and Gaza. I would like to know, sir, what is the policy of the quartet with respect to Gaza? My understanding has been from the beginning that the quartet hoped to show the citizens of Gaza that there was a better life in the West Bank and that the Hamas should be rejected. I remember being in Gaza City shortly after the election and being told that if that was the policy, that Hamas would be the last man standing. I would like your views on whether that was really the policy. And secondly, what do you think the impact is in terms of the youth who, a large majority of whom, have no economic opportunity whatsoever and may have other ways to work out their frustrations. Thank you.
Well, I think on the second part of your question, it's what I was just addressing. It is that I think there is an acute frustration amongst the youth. If you have 60% plus unemployment, you have, whether it's in Gaza or whether it's in any country, you have a hell of a problem in containing the emotions and the frustrations of youth. It's not an Arab issue. It's an issue that you can't have that and have peaceful development. So I would say that that issue is pretty clear. And the first part of your question related to
the Quartet's policy.
The Quartet's policy, yeah. What George Mitchell has been trying to do since in the last 2.5 years, it's Tony Blair was trying to do it, was to intervene in relation to the question of how these issues can be solved. But as the gentleman behind you knows, the Quartet's the Quartet envoy has a very limited mandate. In my case, I thought that the mandate was greater, and for a time, people humored me by pretending that I did in fact have a mandate to go beyond economic development. But if you read carefully the terms of the Quartet envoy, it is essentially an economic post. It is not a political post. And to drive that home, to me, I was told by some of my members of the Quartet, notably this country, that the furniture was about to be removed and that we should close the office. And in a short period of time, I had a farewell party to the members of my team from the Quartet. It was a sad but liquid affair that we had in Jerusalem, and we parted. Shortly after that, there was the solution to the problem, which was an invasion of Gaza, which lasted, as you'll remember, maybe 24 hours, and that initiative turned on itself and made the relations even worse. Then when there was a resumption of the idea about the Quartet, it's a long story, but basically Tony Blair took it on, and he has had a limited mandate ever since. So I would say that the Quartet has little or no activity other than economic, and that the weight is now clearly, as it was with Secretary Rice and her colleagues, very much a U.S.-driven activity, because the concession to the Quartet was a concession, in my judgment, and was never really real. And if you can wait till June or July when my book comes out, it will give you chapter and verse in relation to it. And I hope you'll all buy a copy, because it's such an exciting story.
That's right.
Ralph Krauss, retired research chemist. While the Nigerian who was apprehended in Detroit did not come from a deprived background, I wondered still what role or effect that shock and awe bombing, search and destroy missions, demolition of housing, and seizure of borders has contributed or generated suicide bombers.
Well, there's not been, to the visible suicide bombers, whether they're in the region of Palestine, Israel, or in other places, including our own country, of the attacks of more than 5 years ago, the people that were conducting those attacks were by and large educated, reasonably financially supported. So it was not that group of people that can't get work. And the experience thus far in suicide bombings, other than in local events where someone straps dynamite to themselves and kind of blows up something. But the big ones have been done by a more intellectual group, and indeed this gentleman, I think the most recent one was a graduate of London School of Economics, I think. So there's not a necessary connection between inability to get work and suicides. But one thing that I think is very clear at the moment is that the overall economic disadvantage and the actions of the Israeli military, while the Israelis would, I think, justify it on the basis of a response to continued pressure, doesn't really play well with either the general community or with the Palestinians, because it seems that if you have 1,500 people killed and 500 injured in the attacks, that is disproportionate to the problem. And I would say that world opinion is probably in support of that view. On the other hand, if you talk to Israelis, public opinion there is that it was responsive to what has been happening to them. It is a very, very difficult issue. There are some wise people, however, that are trying to resolve it and saying that resolving that particular argument is not essential to bringing about a peace. And Abu Mazen is one of them, and the Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad, is another. They are not trying to win that argument. They're maintaining their position, but they're moving on to try and see if there can be a resolution of the economic and other issues, and 70% of the people, both Palestinian and Israeli, would like to see some sort of settlement. And they're not they're not defining it directly by lines. So I think there is a strong feeling, and the one thing that I've noticed in the last few years is that there are many, many more informal contacts between the Palestinians and the Israelis at the business level and in the constructive level, civil society level, than was apparent when I was the envoy. I've been to both the Palestinian territories and Israel many times in the last few years, and it really surprises me and pleases me that underneath the rhetoric, which is ever more vigorous and maybe more justified, there is nonetheless a group of young Palestinians and Israelis and some older leaders, of whom I probably would put at the top Shimon Peres, who really see through this and see that the ultimate answer has to be peaceful coexistence.
Gary, I'm going to give you the last brief question, then we're going to go to the panel.
Thank you. Gary Mitchell from the Mitchell Report. Mr. Wolfenson, I'm interested in your perspective on the extent to which the battle of the narratives has a role in this issue, and particularly with respect to youth disillusionment. And what I'm referring to is the notion that I think we have sort of taken the easy path of saying that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda don't really offer an alternate vision, but for some, the notion of a caliphate is an alternate vision, and that it's imperative on us writ large to engage in a counter-narrative. And I'm interested in your thinking about whether, A, that's accurate, and B, whether you think that's something that can have an influence, particularly on youth.
I obviously have read and listened to arguments at that level, but I don't think this thing is going to be solved at that level. I think the debate is going to be about what were the conditions that were established, probably first by Bill Clinton, which are not going to be modified very much other than in relation to the physical arrangements on the ground. 95% or so of the land is clear. 5% will be a land swap. It's unlikely that you'll have a return of the Palestinians other than a symbolic return, that the rest of the issue will be solved by compensation, that you'll do a deal on Jerusalem, and the quicker that you can get there, in the end, that's going to be the resolution of the problem. And the Israelis will insist on having a united Jerusalem, and they'll back down from that. They'll have to. And what is critical is that, in my judgment, that the United States at some point gives this the priority to insist on it, because I don't think there's much time. And I think if it is not resolved, then the issue will become far less important, that you will then have an issue of a single Israeli state for years with a large and growing Palestinian involvement, ultimately possibly a majority, with the Jewish settlers becoming, or the Jewish and the Israeli inhabitants being more and more influenced by a fast-growing religious group, which is destabilizing Israeli society. And I think, I haven't spoken to Bibi about it, but I think that the leadership in Israel must recognize that the next year or two is the time when you have to do a deal. I think it all changes after that. I think at the moment you could get Arab support for a deal. Who knows what will happen in 2 years' time? There may be a whole lot of other internal issues which make it impossible. So my own belief is, if I were Israeli or if I were Palestinian, I would be looking to try and get something done. And the fact that 60 to 70% of the Israeli and Palestinian population believe that makes me believe that there is a chance. I just hope the leadership will carry it through. But in the next panel, you have real experts. So you should ask them instead of listening to a superannuated former civil servant.
But still Olympian fencer. That's a perfect segue, obviously, Jim. Before we give up the podium to the panel that's going to be coming up here now, I want to thank you, but I also hope you will join me in inviting everybody who was here to come back for a discussion of your book when it comes out.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll give a discount, too, to anybody.
Fall discount.
Good afternoon, everyone. The panel is here, and it's going to be quite a task to come after Jim Wolfenson and Strobe Talbot, but we'll try to do our very best. My name is Jean-Louis Sarbib. I'm a non-resident senior fellow at the Wolfenson Center for Development, and I'm delighted to be moderating this very, very distinguished panel. We have the pleasure and the honor of being joined by Representative Keith Hellison from the 5th Congressional District of Minnesota at the U.S. House. His philosophy is, as he describes it, one of generosity and inclusiveness, and he has tried to reflect the concerns of his constituency in the work that he's doing in many, many areas, including human rights, and he will talk to us about some of his experience in visiting Gaza. To his right is Daniel Levy, who is the Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation. And he comes to us with a long experience of negotiating peace agreements. He was the senior advisor to Prime Minister Barak and to Yossi Benlin when he was Minister of Justice. He was part of the Israeli delegation to the Taba negotiations, some of the results of which Mr. Wolfenson just mentioned. To his right, Amjad Atallah is his co-director of the Middle East Task Force and the New America Foundation, and a specialist in negotiations in conflict and post-conflict situations. He has advised the Palestinian negotiating team. So you have the person who advised the Israelis and the person who advised the Palestinians. And as Jim was saying earlier, they're talking to each other and they're friends, so that there is hope. Then to my immediate right, we have Andrew Whitley, who is from UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, that has a long history of involvement with Palestine. And Andrew is also in earlier life as a journalist with the Financial Times and other prestigious newspapers. And he actually wrote 20 years ago a book about the future of the economic future of Palestine.
An article. Not a book.
You can have said a book. That's okay.
And
finally, we have Edward Sire, who is an assistant professor at the University of Southern Mississippi and the author of a very interesting piece of this book, Generation in Waiting, which is the sum of the work to date of the Wolfensohn Center on the Middle East Youth Initiative. And it is a joint publication of the Wolfensohn Center and the Dubai School of Government. And Edward has also spent quite a bit of time at the Palestine Economic Policy Research Institute. So we have a panel of people who know the region and have demonstrated their commitment. But I'd like to start with you, Congressman Ellison, and ask what images, what struck you when you visited Gaza in February of last year?
You know, that's a great question. But first of all, let me thank Mr. Wolfensohn, Mr. Talbot, the Brookings Institute, and the New America Foundation, and all of you. A year after that very catastrophic set of events that we know now as Operation Cast led, to see everyone in this room, like standing room only, demonstrates that the world's attention has not been taken off this crisis, and I think that's a good thing. You know, as I think about what I saw a year ago and what I hope to see in a few days when I go back to Gaza, a reporter asked me, you know, 1 year later, Keith, you know, what do you think, what has been done? It seems to me, speaking from the reporter's perspective, that nothing has changed. My response to the reporter was, we'd be fortunate if nothing had changed. It's gotten worse. The fact is that since Operation Cast led, the factories that we toured, which were bombed out and destroyed, clearly have not opened again. The hundreds of people that were working in a particular biscuit factory are still unemployed. A group of men that I walked up and was talking to had constructed like a little hut from cinder blocks. I wouldn't be surprised if those same fellows who are about the same age as I am, you know, they got kids to think about, wives to care for, and families to think about. They're probably still not working at this very moment. I went into a grocery store in Jabalia camp, and I was told that there was a shortage of shekels in the economy, just paper notes. They just didn't have enough. So I decided, to buy some stuff and just give it to somebody. And I did that. And so I bought some candy bars. I was told that they came not through the checkpoints, which are still closed, but through the tunnels from Egypt, which have increased in number. And so when I bought these shekels, when I bought these candy bars, I couldn't eat all these candy bars. So I gave them to the kids who were outside. And then they all kept coming up. And I was told that these children, their parents can't buy them these candy bars because the premium that's placed on those items is just too high for the average Gazan to possibly afford. Those children who went to that school, maybe they went to the American school in Gaza. Well, that school is still destroyed and bombed down. And it's probably before the bombing, you could have gone in there, perhaps rebuild. It's still no concrete, no glass. Those items have not been put forward to build that school back up. And the people who ran that school, who started that school, are still jamming into very limited space in order to try to educate children. We went to the Al-Quds Hospital. and the psychosocial room, which had the most interesting depictions of Disney characters, Goofy and all the cartoons painted on the wall. One half was Disney characters, the other half was charred remains of what used to be the wall. I'm pretty sure that wall has not been repaired, and that the post-traumatic stress that those children have been suffering from has not been alleviated. I'm also sure that the children in southern Israel who we met in Sderot are still hoping and praying that a rocket doesn't hit their home. They're still running for bomb shelters as they play in playgrounds in Sderot. It's still a very awful condition. But let me just make a few more points as you ask me what's changed. Well, since Operation Cast Lead, we all will remember. I don't know if Bibi Netanyahu and the conservative coalition that was swept into office post-Cast Lead would be there or not, but they certainly are there now. It's clear that Israel's diplomatic position has slid backwards. They used to have a working relationship with Turkey. That has been damaged. Morocco, they've had relationships that's been damaged. And I think diplomatically, and since the Goldstone report was released, clearly there's been diplomatic damage to Israel. And the fact is that I think in the final analysis, it's been a catastrophic for everybody. And so we passed the credibility of the United States Congress has been harmed since Operation Cast.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. All right. We'll come back.
You put
to
me
that.
On a roll. Sorry.
No, I know it's hard to stop talking, especially that the numbers are indeed quite shocking. Just to illustrate. But
before I go, can I just make a quick announcement? Forgive me. Next week, Dr. Izzedine Elaish, who lost three of his children and a niece, we'll be on Capitol Hill on the January 20th. You're all invited. And he's alive and teaching at University of Toronto, but his children casualties. And we also are preparing a resolution filled with quotes from American public officials on a need to address the humanitarian conditions. So with that, I just...
We'll come back to you. This is not your last chance to, speak. But I just wanted to illustrate a figure. The congressman just talked about the destruction of productive capacity. In June 05, before the withdrawal, there were 3,900 industrial establishments in Gaza that occupied and employed 35,000 people. In December of 08, the 3,900 had become 200. And after the Operation Cast Lead, it had become 70. And the 35,000 people employed have come down to 1,900. So those are numbers that we all should ponder when Congressman said the situation is not the same, it's gotten worse. And we're lucky that Andrew here has a view, a longer view of what has been happening in the occupied Palestinian territories. And maybe you want to share with us what you see today and where we come from.
Thank you very much, Jean-Louis. Ladies and gentlemen, in September, last September, the General Assembly of the UN held a solemn commemorative event marking the 60th anniversary of UNRWA. It was not a cause for celebration, but it was a moment to pause and reflect on the fact that the refugee question still persisted 60 years on. The speeches really didn't matter, and they didn't last at all, but what really made an impact on almost everyone who saw it was a huge poster that we had that draped the entire General Assembly building, which was very dramatic, and it was a montage of pictures of young, happy, smiling boys and girls jostling for attention for the camera, holding up the little items, and the slogan underneath, "Peace starts here." And that is our goal, that we believe that it is the young people, many of whom are refugees. In Gaza, 70% of the population are refugees. 1.1 million are registered with UNRWA out of 1.5 million estimated total population. And these people clearly are so yearning and desperate for someone to give them something tangible to hang on to as means of hope for the future. And indeed, as you've heard from other speakers, the prospects are pretty bleak indeed. Jean-Louis has just been referring to the employment statistics from local manufacturing. Well, virtually all other alternatives for sources of employment have also been progressively eliminated. As Jim Wolfenson knows very well, the previous main source of employment used to be day labor in Israel. That's closed and gone. There used to be a very extensive agriculture in Gaza, almost completely destroyed, almost completely gone, virtually no source of self-reliance there. The fishing industry, almost completely decimated. The local manufacturing as subcontractors for Israeli companies, those very profitable business links. Mr. Wolfenson referred to the business contacts between the West Bank businessmen and the Israeli companies. Sadly, that is not happening for the highly entrepreneurial Gazan business elite. And that's tragic, because these are the people who can provide local employment there. So what are the alternatives for young people? Today, you can work for the Hamas security forces. You can be on the UNRWA payroll and be able to be a doctor or a nurse or an engineer. But there's a limit to our ability to support people. And it's not our job, ultimately, to replace the private sector. Or else you can work in the tunnel economy, which has been a thriving business for the last year. And that, fortunately from the point of view of cutting down on the arms smuggling, but unfortunately from a humanitarian perspective, because most of the goods coming in have been the essentials of daily life to support people, looks as if that avenue will now be cut off. So once again, another door will be closed. I would very much hope that the counter to that would be that there would be relaxations on the Israel crossings. I'm not sure that it will happen, but we must continue to argue and advocate that it should be, because clearly the alternative is going to be continuing deepening sense of isolation, of frustration, of radicalization. And what has changed in the past year is virtually nothing in terms of the conditions on the ground, except that Hamas is much stronger than before. Hamas is more entrenched in power. The population is more radicalized than it was. I'm not saying Hamas is more popular, but it's more powerful and it's more determined to exert its own authority over all aspects of life.
Well, this is again a very, very sobering picture, but there is a need to think a bit more specifically about, in this overall picture, what is the potential for youth to find a way towards hope, employment, and I think, Edward, I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit what your research has been showing on these issues.
Right, just to set the stage a little bit to think about, to coming back to some things Representative Ellison said as well as Mr. Whitley, is that the situation even before the Gaza war was fairly bleak in the Gaza Strip, especially for the youth. If you look back at what had happened in the previous 10 years, there is an average halving of the income from 2000 to 2008 already, and this is largely due to the blockade that had been in place for several years. But in addition to that, the dire situation for the youth of Gaza is much more severe than what's going on in the overall economy. Some basic statistics about this include the fact that over 75% of the population of Gaza is under the age of 30, approximately 32% of that between the age of 15 and 29, and the rest is under the age of 15. And every cohort, every new group of students that enters the school systems in Gaza is the largest one on record. On the other end of the educational system, these students are now going out into the labor force, and they're going out and trying to get jobs. And again, every year is a record number of job seekers. On average, in Gaza Strip in 2008, for example, 20,000 new job seekers entered the labor force. And this is in a situation where previously there were some release valves for these new workers, that they could go to the Gulf to get jobs, or they could go to Israel to get jobs, or there's a possibility for more opportunities even in the West Bank than there might have been in the Gaza Strip. All of these opportunities have now been shut off. And because of that, it is the lack of the ability to reach markets by producers, the ability to get raw materials by producers, and the ability to access your consumers as well for these manufacturers that really hold some potential for hope of creating a dynamic Gazan economy that has been completely shut off. Even before the war last year, the cost of some of the mobility restrictions, even when the borders were open, were putting a surcharge of roughly 50 to 60% on every good that was produced in Gaza. They would have to go through these security measures that would involve back-to-back trucking measures where they would have to be unloaded from a Palestinian truck to be then loaded onto an Israeli truck and hand-checked everything that passed through Israel. These sorts of restrictions dampened the ability of manufacturers in Gaza to do much even before the war. And now, after roughly $2 billion of damage to the Gazan economy that has not been rebuilt, the situation is just much more dire than it even was then.
Amjad, would you like to build on this picture? And I'd like to start talking a little bit about what you think might need to happen. What are some of the possibilities to begin to think more positively about getting us out of that very, very dire situation?
Well, I mean, I think we've had a very dismal picture presented of the situation on the ground. How would you make that worse? Well, link the United States directly to it and link the consequences of what's happening in Gaza specifically to American national interests, and then it becomes not simply a theoretical problem about what the Israelis and the Palestinians have to deal with, but I think it becomes a problem of what we have to deal with. The president did a remarkable job in his Cairo speech almost a year ago in presenting a new narrative to the Muslim world of the United States as a partner, of the United States with a restart, with a new beginning with the Muslim world based on mutual respect, reciprocity. He did something no previous president, as far as I can tell, has done, in which he actually equated the Jewish right to self-determination with the Palestinian right to self-determination, and said that these were both equally necessary and equally in American national interests, which was a very profound statement, I think, that a lot of Muslims all across the world grabbed onto. And one thing he did was he specifically stated that the lifting of the siege on Gaza, and he did that in subsequent statements as well, and he did it before the Cairo speech, was that the lifting of the siege on Gaza was something that the United States was demanding and that needed to be done. So now it's a year later. Now, I was in Gaza with a congressional delegation last summer, and one thing that was remarkable was that every Gazan we met asked, when is the United States going to free Palestine or when is the United States going to free Gaza? They didn't ask when Hamas was going to do it, and they didn't ask when Fatah was going to do it. As a matter of fact, no Palestinian that we spoke with spoke about Fatah or Hamas. They spoke about the United States, and they asked the congressman, when are you going to free Gaza? The idea that the United States is impotent or completely unable to exercise influence over Israel or Egypt, and that the United States cannot open the borders at all from either the Egyptian side or from the sea or from the Israeli side, is something that no Palestinian in Gaza that we met believed. I suspect it's also something that no Muslim in the world believes. Now, that puts us in a quandary, because it means that over the last year, the United States has been specifically associated with the siege on Gaza, which has become iconic of the Palestinian struggle as a whole for the Muslim world. And unless, and this would be a perfect place for the United States to effectively begin, you know, we're not hostage to the Palestinians or the Israelis. I mean, sometimes it seems that we are, but we're not, in fact. We have our own decision-making capacity. We have also our own ability to influence events, independent of what Israel decides to do and independent of what the Palestinians decide to do. One place we could start is on Gaza. One place we could start is on lifting the humanitarian conditions that are affecting the people in Gaza. We met a boy who couldn't have been more than 16, and he was telling us about a friend of his who had a son, born in April, who he named Obama because they had so much hope. It was, if you went to a lot of Palestinian homes in the past, you'd see pictures of Kennedy up on the walls. People would have these carpets, like Afghan carpets, up on the wall with pictures of Kennedy, who had a kind of iconic status among Palestinians. And it seemed that the same thing was happening with Obama. At the same time, we met a woman who was standing in front of her home, which had been bombed out during the war. And she kept asking the congressman and the congresswoman, when are you going to rebuild my house? When are you going to rebuild my house? When are you going to rebuild my house? And nobody, of course, had an answer to that. The only concrete that's being shipped into the Gaza Strip is coming through the tunnels. And Gazans can't afford that. The only glass that's coming in is coming in through Egypt from the tunnels. It's not coming in from the border. So I think the United States, in one hand, the good news is that if the United States had the political will to actually make a statement and a stand on Gaza, it could. Now, the bad news is for a year we haven't. And it's hard to see how there's going to be a positive, constructive peace process moving forward if Gaza is not part and parcel of that.
Danielle, what's the view from Israel?
I think the dominant narrative in Israel remains one of, as Jim Wolfenson discussed earlier, Israel left in 2005. There was the continuation of rocket attacks. Where's the love? Where's the gratefulness for the withdrawal? The fact that most of the international community has not recognized an end of occupation because Israel continues to control the sea, the air, the border exits, other than, of course, the Egyptian one. The conditions of that withdrawal, its unilateralism, there being nothing but entrenchment in parallel on the West Bank, the immediate imposition of a blockade, the non-implementation of the access and movement agreement, doesn't really factor into the equation. What I would argue in terms of how this affects Israel is if you take everything we've just heard and then reflect back on what Jim Wolferson shared with us earlier of this cohort of 15 to 25-year-olds, the under 15-year-olds, which applies even more so in Gaza than in the rest of the region, where you think about this act of deindustrialization that's taking place. It's not been about how do we create more jobs, but job creation has been discouraged and literally driven underground with the Talon economy. How on earth can that serve the security of Israel living next door? How can a population seething with angry young people be in Israel's security interest? And I think Israel is building a security nightmare, a future security nightmare for itself, with the conditions that have been created in Gaza. Now, unfortunately, the combination of no Israeli being allowed into Gaza. Myself and Amjad were together hosting a congressional delegation. I'm an Israeli citizen. I couldn't be part of that visit to Gaza. No Israeli, even journalist, has been allowed into Gaza in the last 3 years. There have been some very creative and brave attempts by some of the human rights community. For instance, we have the representative of B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights group, Uri Zaki, here with us. They have distributed video cameras to Gazans to record stories. I think this was reported in the New York Times, that have then appeared on some of the most popular Israeli news websites to give Israelis some sense of the reality inside Gaza. But I think what you've seen, as has been discussed, if anything, is a radicalization. And today one sees Hamas as the bulwark against a phenomenon of al-Qaeda wannabes and al-Qaeda copycats emerging in Gaza. So I think the blockade is undermining rather than contributing to Israeli security. And, of course, security has to be considered more broadly. And in that respect, international legitimacy is a component of Israel's national security. And I would argue that nothing has done more to dent and undermine and erode that for Israel than the actions that took place during Operation Cast Lead and than the ongoing imposition of the closure on Gaza. If I put it in the context of where we are today, this attempt to relaunch a peace process, in the absence of addressing what's going on in Gaza, you're basically playing Russian roulette with any peace process that you attempt to launch. It's such a potentially destabilizing factor, as happened last year. Turkey was involved in Israeli-Syrian mediation efforts. That ended as soon as CAS-led began. So I think the attempt to launch a peace process and kind of hope that no one will notice that Gaza is still there, it is not a smart way to go, especially, and I'd just like to add one more point, which is what Amjad really focused on, which is if the humanitarian angle isn't good enough for you, and if the Israeli security angle isn't compelling enough for you, then there is an American, I would argue, national security interest here. When Secretary Clinton goes to Sharm to a donor conference that took place last March, commits money to Gaza that can't be dispersed because you can't get stuff in, when there is a new American peace envoy who has yet to set foot in Gaza a year into office, that doesn't do any good. By the way, when someone like Keith Ellison visits Gaza, I would say that does more for American security in the Middle East and your public diplomacy than virtually anything else we've seen. And sorry to embarrass you if I have, than almost anything we've seen this year. When Egypt is building a barrier on its side of the border, which may even strangle the tunnel economy, there are American engineers involved. America's getting blamed for this in the Arab world. America's getting blamed for the Israeli actions in the Arab world. So if it's not high enough on the American agenda, and if an envoy hasn't been there yet, and I understand there are State Department rules, but I guess an envoy would be in a position to at least question whether he can circumvent those rules. I think this is very troubling for the U.S.
But I think that what you said and what Amjad said is, to me, there is a real deficit of knowing what the situation is. And I'd like to ask you, Andrew, what do you think should be done or can be done to change the image of Gaza as a place that is full of Hamas-led terrorists, to really emphasize the humanitarian and essentially the total lack of hope that exists there? What can we do so that people get a sense of the situation?
Well, voices of ordinary people is very important indeed, and I'm delighted that Representative Ellison is going to have this brave Gazan doctor to be able to come and speak there. We've got a group of young children, ninth graders, who are going to be coming to the United States, supported by the U.S. government. These are human rights students who've excelled in our program of human rights, peaceful conflict resolution, and tolerance. And as a reward, they're going to be able to go to Atlanta, to the Carter Center, come to Washington, meet the people in government, and then come to New York, to the United Nations. These are a group of girls, 14, 15-year-olds, as well as boys, who will come a week later. And people will be able to hear the authentic voice of young people, what they see as their future. And I find it remarkable that despite everything that Gazans have gone through in the past years, that young people are still committed to the idealism of human rights, and that they still can feel that there is something that's important and relevant to their lives, rather than going in the other direction and becoming potential suicide bombers or militants in some group or other. In addition to that, naturally, I would like to encourage far more people to be able to get into Gaza whenever they can, to see for themselves. I hope that more congressional delegations will be able to go back there. And I would like to be able to see more of the business elite, who we hardly hear anything about. People who have a strong desire to reestablish ties with their Israeli counterparts, because that was good business for them, and it was something that they had known that they can do to be able to promote local employment in the area. Let's start talking about companies that can help to be able to reestablish those links to those Gazan manufacturers who can do such a good job for them, and start to give people some meaningful sources of employment.
But that's assume again that the blockade is lifted.
Absolutely, that's the precondition for everything.
The another number. The Palestinian Trade Authority estimates that in order for the economy to work, they need about 850 truckloads a day. At best, there have been 127. At the very best, and sometimes none at all.
Probably only 20%, and most of the range of goods is very limited. Israel has deliberately chosen in an arbitrary, sometimes rather cruel fashion, the things that can come in and that cannot come in. We had long periods of months when there were no light bulbs that could be entered into Gaza, no batteries for hearing aids for young children. I mean, this is cruel and perverse.
Congressman Ellison.
I just wanted to add that after me and Brian Baird left Gaza, we met with a member of USAID, very committed servant and very committed public servant, and he asked us a question that actually startled me. He said, well, what did you see there? What's going on there? I said, well, don't you know? You must be here every day. He said, no, we haven't been there since 2003. There was a convoy that was attacked, and instead of taking a tactical step back to figure out how we go in there, we simply don't go in there, and we work through other agencies. So one thing we can do today, now, don't even need a piece of legislation, is have USAID personnel reenter Gaza. That's something we can do now. You can write a letter and ask the secretary to do it. And I think it's something that I've written a letter. I've even asked the secretary about this in congressional hearings. And I hope that you all will join me in asking that happen. Somebody's clapping. Let me also say, after we left that meeting, we went and met with an Israeli military official who referred to Hamas as Hamastan. Hamastan. We can't do anything for Hamastan. It's Hamastan. And we had to say, you know, my friend, 75% of the people there are under 30, and another 60%, 58% are under 18. So they did not vote for Hamas. The majority of the residents didn't do that. We've got to help counteract this idea that anything goes in Gaza because it's Hamastan. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea is operating. I think that whether or not the Israelis are deliberately doing this or not, I think the policy, the de facto policy, is a policy of provocation. Mm. And I know that, and I think we've got to really, we need to help our friends reflect on, you know, what they're doing. Because I don't think that there's a real thoughtful idea about the overall impact of what the policy is. And finally, we had to argue, you know, can they have macaroni in Gaza? He said, well, I think they already have it. I said, well, no, they don't. They said they don't have macaroni there, and they don't have lentils, and they don't have much of anything else. And he said, well, I'll check on the macaroni. And then a few days later, I heard there's a little macaroni, but I don't know if there's still macaroni or not. So we're debating macaroni here. And I think we need to reflect on that, too. You know, so.
But before I give the floor back to Daniel, I'd like to ask you, how much knowledge is there among your colleagues in Congress? I don't mean to put you on the spot about what the situation is.
If you want to know how much knowledge there is about my colleagues in Congress, all you need to do is look at the vote on the Goldstone report, wherein the United States Congress voted to, what is the language, not in any way accept any of the findings of the Goldstone report. And the vote was something like, only about 58 people voted either present or no, and everyone else voted for it. And one of our big objections to passing this resolution is that, other than Brian Baird and I bet nobody read the Goldstone report or even the executive summary. So we're ready to condemn a report which we have not read at all. That's how much we know about it.
Thank you.
That give you a good indication about how much we know? Yeah.
Danielle, you wanted to.
This reminds me of a conversation, perhaps close to an argument, that I often find myself in with my Israeli friends, and the line will be, well, why is this different to what America is doing in Afghanistan, in Iraq? There is a civilian price. There are civilian casualties. It's horrible in any circumstance. Now, I'm not a huge fan of the application of counterinsurgency doctrine everywhere. But at the core of that is the idea that in a conflict situation, if you don't like a group of people in control of a particular area or a regime, you are trying to win over the civilian population. And I think where Israel has got it so horribly wrong in Gaza is it's punishing the entire civilian population. There's no distinction here drawn.
In fact, if you open the border crossings, you'd be allowing the aid and assistance organizations who are committed to their assistance not going to governmental purposes in Gaza. You'd be allowing them to you'd be allowing the private sector to rebuild. You would be allowing them to rebuild the kind of institutions of civil society. Now, I'm not saying a regime change approach is a good idea, but there is an Israeli policy which is essentially, and this is what the Goldstone report found that was so problematic beyond the individual acts, it's essentially collective punishment. And not only is that in contravention of international humanitarian law, there's a reason you ain't doing that in the parts of the world that you're involved in. And I think that's the conversation that I'm having with fellow Israelis, but that friends of Israel need to be having in a much more forward-leaning way with Israeli counterparts.
Well, in the panel earlier, Jim Wolfenson was talking about the fact that there is an increasingly vocal and extremist religious growing force in Israel. Those arguments that you've just made, what echo do they have in Israel?
I mean, as I said, I think for the vast majority of the population, see no Palestinian, hear no Palestinian, think no Palestinian is the best way to go about daily life. And by the way, there's a human understandable element to that. It's not that the information is not accessible, it's people would rather not access it. In governmental circles, I think one can have a sensible conversation with the current Israeli leadership. I think it's partly the mistake of the US, the international community, that they've gone along with what's known as a West Bank First policy, which is make conditions, show the Palestinians that if you live under a moderate PA Fatah regime, it's good. And the corollary to that is, if you live under Hamas, it's bad, which means you're actually encouraging this policy. So if your meta-narrative is to encourage the policy, then you're in a weak place when you're trying to talk on a micro with Israel about saying, no, let the macaroni in, mm-hmm. because your meta-policy is problematic. That there's a very important report released by various international aid and assistance NGOs called Failing Gaza, which is worth looking up. Mercy Corps, Oxfam, and others. And it goes into this, of what the international community has failed to do. Obviously, there's the UNRWA material as well. So I think you could kickstart a conversation. You know, I think there is a potential receptivity in Israeli official circles, but I don't think it's being challenged enough.
Now, if I were to ask each one of you, what do you think needs to be done right now to get the situation and frozen, both in terms of getting information out and maybe finding points to restart a dialogue? After all, there is a need or a willingness on the part of the U.S. government, which came in very big in some of the interventions, to do something new. So where do we start? Amjad, I'll start with you, and I'll go across the panel.
Well, I think very simply, the United States has to stop trying to identify what we want the Israelis to do and what we want the Palestinians to do and identify what we need to do. And there are things that we, of course, ask the Israelis to do and we ask the Palestinians to do, but there are things that we can do, and those are the things we should identify and start doing right away. One of them, for example, is we can't possibly help Egypt build an iron wall to break off the tunnels until we've actually opened up the borders to humanitarian and reconstruction goods. So we can open up the borders to humanitarian and reconstruction goods. The mechanisms to make sure that Hamas is not the distributor and recipient of those goods has already been worked out. Andrew can go into detail about it, but it's already on paper. Everybody, the details of how to do it are already there. And Hamas will not be in the position of saying no, don't open up the borders because we're not going to be allowed to be the one driving the trucks or distributing the goods. They're not going to. That's an untenable position for them to be in, so they can't say no to it. So the United States can begin opening up the borders, even from Egypt, even if we can't do it from the Israeli side, and begin to be seen. I mean, imagine the visual impact throughout the world of the United States being the liberator and the one distributing aid and freeing the children of Gaza. Imagine that optic as opposed to U.S. Army Corps of Engineers building giant steel wall with Egypt to block off the last remaining candy bars that are coming into Gaza. Those are the two competing narratives right now. And, you know, I just don't see the benefits to the United States in being involved with the negative one.
Daniel?
I'd say three things. First of all, move your policy to a position where you can be raising this issue in terms of the strategic long-term interests, the stuff in your chapter, the stuff that Jim Wolferson talked about, that Andrew has talked about. America has a strategic dialogue. There's an incredible density of relationship with Israel. So be moving that conversation. The second thing I would say is, in terms of dealing with the practical problem, remove the pretexts. If part of Israel's predisposition vis-a-vis Gaza is related to the Shalit situation, to getting the freedom of the Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, and I hope he's freed, be encouraging that deal. America doesn't have the key role to play here, but certainly be encouraging that deal. If one of the pretexts is that, well, who can we deal with in Gaza? Then I would say be encouraging Palestinian reconciliation for many, many reasons, but this can perhaps be one of them. So remove the immediate reasons for not doing that, and be demonstrating that you care. Gaza has to be right up there in the talking points. There was a very significant European foreign minister's statement in December. Read the clause on Gaza in that statement. If American leaders, every time they spoke about the Middle East, were beginning to use that kind of language, I think that would be important. Of course, eventually it would have to be translated into practice. Have USAID folks in there. Have the special envoy, Senator Mitchell, in there.
I'm going to jump over you and give you the last word, Congressman Ellison, because you're the one who can do something about it.
one of 535. But
it's more than anyone else on this panel can say. Andrew, next.
Look, the previous speakers have addressed the main issues. I think don't take them in isolation. These issues can't be taken one by one. Yes, the prisoner exchange has to happen, and we sincerely hope that it will happen soon. But the price of that is not simply to be able to transfer a number of prisoners over and simply say that's the end of the story. The population of Gaza needs some relief. But if we're going to think a little bit longer term, we have to think about a way to be able to give young people some tangible sense of a better future. How are they going to have that? Where are they going to get some education from? Which educational institutions are they going to go to? How are their teachers going to be able to come in and out? You can't keep 1.5 million people bottled up in a bottle for the last 3 years and throw away the key. The political message that's being sent by Egypt of putting down this massive steel wall along the border is as much a message to Israel, which is to say, we're not going to have the problem pushed off onto us. Don't think that you can lock it away and let us deal with the consequences there. Because remember that Gaza, for many decades beforehand, for 90% of its imports and exports depended on Israel. Its future is there. And you can't imagine that it's simply going to disappear. So there has to be a discussion between the U.S. government and others, with the Israeli government, to simply say, you can't just wish Gaza away.
Yes, I'd like to bring the focus back to the mobility issue that we've all been discussing at some level. And I guess there are two specific things that if I had a wish list that I would ask to be put at the very top of the agenda. The first one has to do with broadening the focus a little bit. And although we've mostly been talking about Gaza, and as Jim Wolfenson mentioned earlier, that the situation in the West Bank has improved, that at the beginning of 2008 there were some 600 or more roadblocks and blockades preventing free movement within the West Bank, and that has been reduced tremendously. However, that reduction is still largely superficial. There's a main artery that's still cut off between Ramallah and Nablus. There is still the blockades that have been removed are only generally temporarily removed, and it kind of comes and goes like the wind, and no one knows why it's going to happen. This is still having a horrible deteriorating effect on the West Bank economy, even though it is shining in comparison to what's been going on in Gaza. And then connected to that, with in addition to not taking our eye off the ball with what's been going on in the West Bank and the mobility restrictions, I think the attention should again be paid to an idea that has been around for a while that has been now dropped, which is this West Bank-Gaza corridor. At the time in 1996 when I was working with a think tank in Ramallah, the discussion was about how expensive it would be to secure it properly, about how the construction costs and such. Since that time, we have now had the security wall built. And since that time, we've now are seeing plans to build more walls along Israel's border, along with Gaza, the southern wall near Eilat. And from the U.S. perspective, there are real resources that we can put in towards assuring some access. We can't guarantee in the future, for example, if a Gazan port would be built, that it wouldn't be again shut down, like the Gazan airport was bombed and such. But with real resources, we could show our earnestness about opening up Gaza Strip, at least to the brethren in the West Bank.
Yeah, I had a very brief word, if I could, Jean-Louis, because it's something we haven't mentioned so far today. To her credit, one of the great achievements of Condi Rice was the 2005 Access and Movement Agreement, the last agreement which Israel, the Palestinian Authority, and the U.S. signed off on. That is the reference point, and we should be going back to that and saying, you signed on to this. And it sets out in a timetable the steps that need to be taken to restore the links between Gaza and the West Bank and to restore normal movement in gradual stages. And that is what's clearly needed, because otherwise we're moving towards a three-state solution.
Thank you. And again, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I am very excited about the energy in the room. Hope we all can stay focused. I would say that in terms of specific action items, we need to get USAID personnel in Gaza. We can do it. It won't be that hard. Two, the Congress needs to commit to UNRWA. UNRWA has been harshly criticized by certain elements in our Congress based on faulty information. But I will tell you that Chairwoman Nita Lowey and Chairman Berman have made very positive statements about UNRWA. But as a whole, there's this always this low hum where we have to defend UNRWA, and I think that that's a shame. We have to encourage Israel to deal forthrightly with the recommendation in the Goldstone Report that they engage in their own process so that we can stop any further diplomatic isolation and help them sort of restore some credibility internationally. I think that's very important, that the Goldstone Report is not asking for a lot. It's just asking for Israel to have its own credible process. I don't think that's too much to ask. Let me also say we've got to stop this thing. You know, there was a bunch of students from Gaza who are held up for their Fulbright scholarships. This is insane. We can't have these kind of things, and we've got to be much more robust and dynamic diplomatically. I also think, and I think this would be a political risk for the president, but I think he should go make a big speech in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, which can help the Israeli population understand that, look, this is not to harm you. The relations are to help you. We want to improve relationships, build, and your security is dependent upon Palestinian viability, statehood, and security. And I think that that's something that I would hope would happen. You know, for a while, I know his approval ratings were down in the single digits there. But I think that in order to loosen the grip a little bit and get some real buy-in from the Israeli population, it's at least something to seriously consider. And then when the call for Palestinian statehood is made, I hope Americans support it. I don't think it will hurt our ally Israel. I think it'll help them, although I think there will be resistance. But I think that it's something that that ultimately is going to happen, and I think that we should be ready for it when it does and should be supportive of that effort.
Thank you. Let me just say what for me, I'm going to open up in a minute. I know there are very people anxious to. There are two things that I'm taking away from this conversation. The first one is really the need for information. That I think that the way in which Danielle put it about the Israelis is also true here. The only thing you want to hear about Gaza is what comforts you in a particular view of the situation. So I think that some information needs to happen, And I hope that some of the people in the press here, we're very happy to provide you with all the information that is needed because, and that's the second point that I'm taking away, is what Amjad said about the fact that it is not about what the Israelis ought to do, what the Palestinians ought to do, but what it is that the United States needs to do. And I think he made a very strong case for the link between a deteriorating situation in Gaza and the security of the United States. So now let me open up, and I would like you, I know this is a subject on which people love to make speeches. So I want you to refrain as much as you want, as you can, and ask questions, because that is why we have people who have been very provocative. So I will start in the very back there, the gentleman with the mustache. And please introduce yourselves.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weinschaub, a former member of the Foreign Service of the United States. A few of our speakers mentioned about the Egyptian wall, about the role of U.S. support for it, and one particularly mentioned the Army Corps of Engineers. I haven't seen any of that in the press or in other sources, and I'd like to ask you if that's based on specific information, or ask our representative from the state of Minnesota, if you're aware through government sources, perhaps congressional inquiries, if in fact there has been such support as that.
Now, actually, I've only heard this in Arab press sources, so I don't know if it's true. But it is being reported in Arab press sources that the United States is involved or that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is involved. The perception of it is as bad as the reality of it. If it's not true, we should correct it right away. I mean, if the United States isn't involved in it, the U.S. government should make a point of specifying that.
Sir,
I think should I answer? Oh, wait.
Yes, please.
I was just asking about Steffer if he knew the answer to your question. I can tell you this. I have heard no objection from U.S. State Department or Congress about the Egyptian project, but I cannot confirm or deny that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is involved, but we will look it up and get back to you if you give us a card.
Sir.
Michael Lame, Rethink the Middle East. This is an incredibly knowledgeable panel. However, there is one shortcoming in that there's no one on the panel even remotely supportive of the Israeli position, and the one Israeli is legitimately and honestly critical of the Israeli government position. So it makes it sound as if it's simply irrational or counterproductive, everything that the Israelis are doing, and I would imagine that there is an argument on the other side. Unfortunately, every humanitarian initiative has a political dimension to it, so I'd like the panel to address the politics of if the siege were lifted and if the prisoner exchange occurred, what impact that would have on Hamas and its popularity not only in Gaza but in the West Bank. And I think this is a concern of the Israelis who, if they do want to make a deal for a Palestinian state with Fatah, find it much more problematic to consider doing a deal with Hamas.
Who would like to take this question?
Well, let me try, rather than trying to channel the Israeli argument, I can tell you what they've told us. I mean, because we met with the Israeli army, and we met with the IDF, and we met with Israeli politicians and Likud officials to ask them, you know, what benefit are you getting from this, and why is this in your interest? And I think Daniel actually basically said it right. It was, and you alluded to it, which is that the pressure on the civilian population will affect political change or will accrue political benefits to the state of Israel. Now, we heard a counter-argument specifically, for example, from the Palestinian Minister of Economy and Trade at the time, who said that Hamas is bringing in over $1 billion worth of goods from Egypt, civilian goods, not counting whatever pieces for rockets or anything that are else being brought in, civilian goods that are coming in from Egypt. They collect the VAT, they collect the tax on that instead of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank collecting a tax on it. And the families and the businesses that are running the different tunnel enterprises are making money off of it. And the goods are being brought in to help complement the goods that UNRWA is able to distribute to the civilian population. But in all of that scenario, the Minister of Economy and Trade said, this does nothing to help moderate or help, you know, it only strengthens, as Andrew said, it makes Hamas more powerful. It doesn't achieve even the Ramallah group's goals of replacing Hamas. It doesn't even achieve those aims. So it came back down to, if you kept pushing and asking, but if, you know, why not macaroni? Why is hummus a problem? Why is hummus not allowed in, et cetera? It always came back to needing to put pressure on the civilian population, either for shalit, either for punitive purposes. And this isn't unique. I mean, the Israelis have done this in the past with the West Bank as well. If you're asking why we haven't heard, that perspective, I would just simply say that, in fact, for the last year, and except for the notable exception of a handful of very brave congressmen and congresswomen, that's, in fact, the perspective you have heard every single day of the year, which is the Likud perspective on why we need to continue punishing the civilian population. I even heard it from American officials in the last administration that they were trying to follow a kind of Nicaragua policy from the 1980s, if you'll recall our Nicaragua policy. And so it sounds hard. I think it's hard to justify. The Israeli ambassador to the United States might be able to put a nicer spin on it than I can. But I think that if anybody has a more or a better...
Can I just add? You know, I think that I take your observation seriously. It might be a good way to pursue another forum and dialogue on this very topic. I think that Ambassador Oren is exceptionally articulate and would probably be glad to come in and offer the Israeli position. And I'd be here if I can work it with my schedule. I'll make sure that it does. But I can tell you that I talked to the Prime Minister, the new one. I talked with the Foreign Minister, the Opposition Leader, the Defense Minister. And their answer, and many others as well, and their answer is, it's when you drill down and you start making the critiques about how it doesn't help Israeli security, they will, after a little bit of dialogue, say, well, it's not really about security. They'll say it's a West Bank first policy to create political pressure to either foment an uprising among the population in Gaza, or at least, or perhaps if there's an election, have the people opt to elect another, have a different outcome in the election. And so I thank you for your question. I think it's a fair one. And I think, but that's what we've received.
And there is a deterrent, restoration of Israel's deterrent capacity component, but that's more to the cast lead and responses to rocket fire. That has less to do with the closure policy. There is a dual use issue in terms of allowing materials into Gaza. I'm not sure what second use macaroni could be put to. But in terms of reconstruction materials, that argument is used. The aid and donor community have tried, and I think a neutral observer would say effectively addressed that dual use, where will the materials go? In fact, when there are a couple of incidents of material being taken from the UN, if I'm right, had to briefly suspend it. You know, if it couldn't guarantee what was happening to its own material. There's the regime change component, although no one believes in it. And you saw that during Operation Cast Lead. There wasn't the appetite to push on and actually physically remove the Hamas regime. My own conclusion is there is not a great deal of deep strategic thinking to it. It's, I don't want to go through it. It's well documented that Israel is not in a place today where it does long-term strategic thinking. But there are political pressures. I mean, certainly if it were to be opened up, you would have members of this coalition who would say, why, when Gilad Shalit is being held there, should we be being allowed materials in? In other words, they're under pressure. There's also a resort to the collective, to openly saying collective punishment. And Israeli officials have been caught out publicly making that argument.
So, I mean, those are the factors, if I can try and...
Gentleman here.
My name is Dmitry Novik. I'd like to return all of you to the theme of this meeting, the fate of the youth of Palestinians, beyond discussion, political struggle with 60 years history, with development bridge along the river, not across the river. So Palestinians lost three generations for productive and healthy life. It's a fact for 60 years. We don't need to use next generation. And the only way to do this with education, international community can and must support financially educated Palestinians until years 30, who is capable to be educated, with all material supply of this education, but only for productive professionals, water engineering, agriculture engineering, and medicine. That's it. No political science, no social science, and all this stuff.
No economics.
We need to be realistic, not empty dreamers. It will be shame if international community will lost another generation. It's my question. Do you support this idea?
Excellent question. One of the things that's unique about the Palestinian situation, partially because of this 60 plus years of history, is that they very rapidly became the most educated of all the Arab countries. And this is partially due to UNRWA schools very rapidly expanding secondary education in the area, and then following with that, tertiary education expanded. I think a greater problem now, actually, though, is what happens afterwards. In just less than 10 years, the number of university students tripled from approximately 40, 50,000 to over 150,000. And that was all in a very short period of time, about 7 or 8 years. The problem that we're now seeing, actually, is that what is happening on the other end. And the average wait time for men, once they graduate from university until they get their first job, is almost 2 years. For women, it's even longer. And so although there is more that can be done with education, I think the more pressing concern really is the employment picture once they've finished their schooling.
Andrew?
Let me pick up on exactly on where we've just left off. UNRWA has 5 vocational training centers, 3 in the West Bank and 2 in Gaza. The second one in Gaza, we started when Gaza disengagement took place in August 2005. We have 10 times as many demands for places in our schools, in our vocational training schools, as we can offer places for them. The demand is so great to be able to have a good skill that is marketable and that can then lead on to a good job. That vocational training center in Khan Yunis, in the center of the Gaza Strip, that we started to do in 2005, was held up for more than 3 years because of the blockade and the subsequent politics and the attempts to try to stifle Gaza off. I personally raised the money for that from the donors to be able to do it. And it was something that we really wanted to do, is to show that Gaza disengagement would lead to something productive. UNRWA educates 200,000 children in Gaza. We have a summer school program of 250,000 children, which acts as a real alternative to Hamas, to create an alternative space for people to realize that there is not a single orthodoxy which is going to rule there. And we are really grateful that the U.S. government is our largest single supporter for it. But I completely agree. Education must lead on to jobs, and clearly we have to find ways of being able to ensure that the link to the job market continues. The future of many of these young people depends on their being able to find a way into the job market, if not in their own area, then perhaps to be able to travel to the Gulf or elsewhere to get jobs.
Well, I think that dire as it is, the situation of young people, educated young people, unable to find jobs is not limited to Gaza. It is a phenomenon that is true throughout the region, and it has a lot to do with what Andrew just said, the link between education and the job market, but also the nature of education, the very skills that are needed today, so that there may be a tremendous increase in enrollment ratios, but the quality of what happens in the classroom, the quality of the teaching, the development of the skills that are needed for the 21st century, that's what needs to change. And it's not simply true in Gaza. It's true throughout the region. Mm. Sir.
Hi, my name is Uri Zaki. I'm the new director of B'Tselem here in D.C. And as Daniel mentioned, we are now engaged in a project of distributing video cameras both in the West Bank and Gaza. This is probably the only way Israelis these days are seeing what's going on there. My question is to Mr. Whitley, and as an Israeli who just moved here, of course, I truly am worried about Israel security. I believe that the siege, as was said here on the stage, is not helping Israel security. But I would like, if you may, elaborate a bit about the alternative of how monetary control regime would be in the gateways to Gaza from Israel look like.
Thank you, because this is a very practical question. The mechanisms by which there could be control of the crossing points through international monitors, and the European Union has offered to be able to do it, to extend the border monitoring regime that they already had established at Rafah to the other crossing points into Israel, in principle, has already been agreed. Provided that one can guarantee to both sides, to the Israeli side, that their security interests will be taken care of, and to the Palestinian side, that there'll be predictability, that it won't be arbitrary, one day closed, one day open. Businesses need predictability. They need to have some sense of perspective of where they're going to go, what kinds of goods can come in, so that they can plan for their own futures. That is very important indeed, to be, as a confidence-building measure for both sides. And I believe that is practical and doable in a very short period of time. And I know that the United Nations would be happy to be able to support that. So that's very important. And I think being able to give a sense of reassurance to the population that they can start to plan ahead for the future, that they can have something to be able to look forward to, that the kids whose educations have been interrupted can complete their education, who've lost their opportunities to go abroad. This is important. So perhaps not everything is going to happen overnight. We know that's unrealistic. But in a staged approach, there has to be a relatively short time frame, because as Jim Wolfenson said earlier, we may lose this opportunity. The divisions are deepening between Gaza and the West Bank. They've been deepening for some years. And we need now to be able to start to knit them back together again. Otherwise, I'm afraid we are moving towards a three-state solution, not a two-state one.
I'll take two more questions. The lady here.
I'm one of those political scientists. I'm Professor Diane Singerman at American University, and I've also been part of the Youth Initiative and have published a working paper. And a comment and then a question. I'm a little concerned that...
Brief comment.
Small comment. I'm a little concerned that the way people are framing things has to do with sort of the Middle East as a bomb and young people as a bomb. And I think it's really important, the work of the initiative, high unemployment, high youth unemployment in places where there are not wars in the Middle East, in Morocco, in Jordan, in Egypt, incredibly high female unemployment, the growth of the informal sector, and what's been happening, this is certainly the horrific scenario in Gaza is incredibly important, but all of these trends are not limited to Gaza. And as Americans, as people organizing foreign policy and also international economic institutions, in some sense, the United States has been pushing neoliberalism, privatization, structural adjustment, we've had a free market without freedoms. And this brings me to the point that Mr. Wolfenson brought up. There's a 1 or 2 year scenario in terms of leadership changes. What can the United States do? We have a Democratic president. Lots of people are incredibly excited about him. His Middle East policies look very familiar to the last regime. So is the United States, what can the United States do about questions of governance in the Middle East? Because there's a tremendous amount of wealth in the Middle East. There's a tremendous amount of private capital in the Middle East. What can we do so that our president takes a lead not only vis-a-vis Israel and Egypt, but also some of the large economic paradigms that aren't working so well here recently, and we have a situation in the Middle East where young people are not a bomb. Young people are not necessarily going to become extremists. Our concern about this is not just about young people becoming terrorists. And I think it's really important that there are fundamental issues that we have to talk about and not talk about our interest in that question just because of this notion of suicide bombers.
Could I make a short comment?
Please.
This book, Generation in Waiting, that Ed wrote a chapter in and has it gives a fantastic and far more in-depth response to an assortment of several countries across the Middle East, many of whom have had problems made worse by war, whether the war is one war or another, and some who have not, but who all have the same underlying demographic issues, and they treat the demographics of it exactly as you say, not as a response simply to, you know, a war on terror, quote unquote, but they treat it from the perspective of development, and they come up with some conclusions in the last chapter on what can be done. So I urge everybody, actually I think they sell the book right outside, so I urge everybody to actually have a look at that.
Mr. Sevi, quick comment?
Please do.
You know, let me tell you this. I think you're absolutely right, and I couldn't agree with you more. We've got to stop looking at the Middle East, Africa, Asia, the whole rest of the world through the lens of counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. We've got to broaden our understanding of the rest of the world. And if Obamaism, you know, represents anything, it is the idea that there's more to life than just worrying about your own security, very narrowly defined. We've got to broaden it. So I think that in Congress right now, we have a whole discussion on trade. And that discussion, which has been brewing for quite a long time, is one in which we are going to say we've got to have human rights, environmental, and labor standards. And we've also got to, if globalization is the reality, then that reality must go hand in hand with labor, environmental, and human rights standards. And so it's kind of a movement, but it's very disjointed and sporadic. Let's work together on it.
But I think that what Dan said about the importance of governance is absolutely fundamental. As somebody who's worked on the Middle East for a good many years, I can say that, in fact, part of the problem with Hamas and Fatah has a lot to do with governance. Mm-hmm. So I think that this mm-hmm. issue is absolutely essential. You wanted to say something?
I just wanted to say briefly that, you know, one of the ways to think about the demographic challenge of the Middle East is, instead of being a threat, is actually being an opportunity, and that's an important way to think about it. You know, as fertility rates are declining very rapidly, we're going to have a very large population of working-age adults that can really benefit the rest of humanity by being engaged, being in the expanding economies of the Middle East, if the right policies are in place, and it is a critical time.
And I just say, there is also at least a case to be made for a more limited American role. Don't prop up these regimes. You don't have to change them, but you don't have to prop them up.
Right. The lady, you have the last question. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Fiona McCauley, Director of Making Sense International. I'm just back from the West Bank, where I was working closely with two of the leading microfinance institutions and NGOs working with youth to develop financial products specifically for young people, as well as the accompanying training so that young people can effectively access and manage savings products like credit and savings. And I know other colleagues are working with training and vocational institutions to make the curriculum more relevant, to prepare them to read market signals, to become the kinds of employees that micro and small and medium businesses want to hire, as well as preparing them with entrepreneurship skills for those who are inclined towards self-employment. What is the advice that you have? What policies or activities do you know about that are coming down the pike that would be useful for these teachers and for the youth themselves who are working so hard to acquire these skills and these necessary services in order to make themselves employable and contribute to their economies? What advice or information do you have that can be shared with them and for international development practitioners like myself who are, you know, working to develop access to these kinds of services?
Edward, you want to take this?
Sure, I'll start with this. Another branch of what the Middle East Youth Initiative is doing is actually focusing on social entrepreneurship. And there is another effort that is going to, there's going to be a roundtable very shortly that's going to discuss tapping into the social entrepreneurs that exist in the Middle East. Currently, there are, especially in the West Bank, they have the tradition of restrictions on the banking sector that, that come from the occupation, such that there's a lot of room to maneuver, essentially. And as a general counsel, as a general advice, you know, the idea of they're doing it on their own and not looking towards the PA or any other outside authority is really the way that they're going to move forward with this, because of all the things that have saddened me over the past 15 years in thinking about the Palestinian economy, especially that in the West Bank, is that there has been more and more of a shift on looking towards the government to solve all the economic problems for them. And this sort of effort that you're describing is really something that I think can, if it's allowed to grow and breathe and such, can really make a huge difference.
Okay, I think we are going to stop here. I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for a very...